Hey, this is Bill, and you are listening to episode 5 of Crosshairs Radio. This week, we are talking to Jeremy Powers. Jeremy Powers, the current U.S. national champion, 3-time national champion. A couple weeks ago, won Gloucester for the 10th time, won Providence as well. Really doesn't need much of an introduction. If you're listening to this episode, you know who Jeremy Powers is. It was a pleasure to talk to him as he is preparing to head off to Europe to race Valkenburg in the next World Cup round. Before we get started with that interview, I just wanted to say a couple words about what you all can do to help me make this podcast possible. It's really easy. Mainly, we have a lot of products out there. We have our Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches book, which is a cyclocross primer. That is available at cyclocrossbook.com. Also at crosshaircycling.com/shop. Have many t-shirts, Svenness t-shirts, a Sven Baller t-shirt. There's a Bears and Bikes t-shirt available now. We also are selling toe spikes, which is something y'all should look at because it's going to come in handy for you in the coming weeks if the weather continues to be rainy and wet and muddy. It's all those little things, just contributing to our cause, and that helps us pay for servers and hostings and all the other things that you need to put on a website and put out podcasts. So that's my plea to you. Anything that you can do to help us keep this train rolling is awesome. And now let's talk to Jeremy Powers. Jeremy, how's it going?
Man, it's going great. It's Monday morning. It's a brisk 50 degrees here in Massachusetts. The dog is sitting on the porch in the sun. I just got done eating breakfast, and it's going to be a good week.
So when I started in the crosshairs, the question that I used to ask everyone, it was sort of the closing question, was, what did you have for breakfast? So we can start there.
Yeah. I had a couple of eggs and some broccoli and some spinach. Kind of lame, but it's the new diet.
So no, are you like no carbs at all, or carbs when you train? What's going on there?
Well, no carbs in the morning necessarily until I start getting ready or going for a ride, just because I haven't. My body doesn't really deal with the carbohydrate directly after a big sleep, so. Yeah, it's just not. I just can't have it. Like there were days when I would wake up and just have a bowl of oatmeal, with maple syrup and berries in it, and it used to just send me for a twirl. So
yeah.
I guess this is the other side of that. It's like being in a different zip code as far as those two meals are concerned. And so, yeah, it's quite a bit different. It's just a lower glycemic breakfast, I would say.
Yeah, so since we're sort of talking day-to-day stuff, you raced on Saturday, had a successful day at Providence. What, training-wise, what did you do? And we'll get back to that, but training-wise, what did you do Sunday? What are you doing today? What's your week look like riding-wise?
There's a couple of things that are different. One of the things, you know, for me, as I've hopped into this more European racing schedule, it changes things quite a bit for me because I lose a lot of days of training to travel. And so, you know, I've said it before, but basically by going or doing one less day of racing, because I don't necessarily need the points for these C2 races, by taking that extra day of recover an extra day and then get back into my training and potentially do a third day or take an additional rest day and get a second day of training. Sometimes in cyclocross, you only race, you know, you race both days and then you train on Wednesday and then you race again. And it's basically like 2 days on, 2 days off, train, 2 days off, and then, you know, race again. So you're basically doing this cycle of like race, recover, open. And so for me, I need to keep building and figuring out how I can get more training days in, but also, you know, stay fit by not losing them to travel. Because, you know, if you do the World Cup schedule 5 times back and forth to Europe, you know, you put 2 days on each side, you're talking about, you know, almost a month worth of training that you lose just racing. And that was something that I felt for sure at the end of the year. I just look at the, you know, my layout on Training Peaks and see how many days I was losing to travel. And it was, it stunk. So So I started killing off some of those C2s because I don't necessarily need the points, especially because I'm going so heavily into Europe and racing the World Cups, and they have so many points available at them. And on the other side, it helps, you know, with my family stuff and also with my staff. You know, they're able to go home a day earlier and so on. So, right. It's good. And it keeps me motivated. You know, I think it really does. It really suits itself to the kind of racing that I'm doing, which is one day 120% as hard as I can go, and there's nothing left when I finish that race. And so, when I start to race 2 days, as I did last weekend in Gloucester, I found myself, you know, holding back on Saturday and then giving more on Sunday. And it's just not the way I like to race. Like, I want to just go 110% and feel like I gave everything, and then I stepped away.
Right. Do you think that, and this is not to call you old, but do you think now at 32 that comes into play as well, where 22, you know, 10 years ago, your recovery, I'm guessing, much faster, so you need to build in that time as well, just so that you're still able to race like you want to every week?
I think I could race every, you know, each day on the weekend still and do fine. Would I be more tired? I might need to take things more seriously. Like, I think the difference is probably going home and stretching and going directly to bed versus like going home on Sunday and maybe, you know, going out to dinner and having a beer with some friends or something like that. I think there's a significant difference, especially as you get older, and definitely with related to like injury or, if you fall or you have a really hard course with a lot of running or something like that. Yeah, for sure. At 32, it's different than, you know, 22. There's no question, but I don't really think I'm there yet with like needing to step back from the racing. I just think that it's very much a motivator for me to go out and just crush one day and literally leave it all out there, because that's the hardest thing for me is getting that feeling of racing a World Cup when I'm not racing a World Cup. And that's really what my heart is set on, is trying to improve that World Cup, trying to chase one of those top fives and really, you know, for myself, get that off my checklist. So I'm doing everything I can in really trying to replicate that type of effort best that I can.
So that brings up an interesting point. You're talking about replicating those efforts in these races that you're doing in the U.S. You've just finished up Holy Week, Gloucester. I've been practicing saying that, by the way, Gloucester. And also
Gloucester.
You don't want to know how I used to say it. And also Providence.
Okay.
So what is your motivation now in these races? You've won both of those events multiple times. What is the motivation? And I wanted to frame this in a way that I know what the motivation is of the guys who are chasing you now. Curtis White and Stephen Hyde specifically. The motivation for them is to beat Jeremy Powers in a straight up race. That's a season goal right there. That will be their biggest win. So you're now the guy getting chased. What's your motivation in these domestic races?
I would say in a couple of things is like, you know, I've raced with a bunch of different generations of racers. And so I know what it's like to be in that position of, I want to beat Tim. I want to beat Ryan. I want to beat Todd. That's just instinct. That's just life. That's, you know, business. That's everything. And whether or not you say it or not, I think that it's how you frame it. It's, you know, with some of these riders, I look for respect as much as I do for the win. Like, I'm fully at peace when one of them beats me. They certainly will. There's going to come a time when I will not win a race that I line up for, you know, and it happens. It's just, that's how it goes. And so I'm really not concerned with, do I win every single race? Do I go undefeated? Of course, that would be an incredible, you know, very small asterisk in the line, but getting back to your original question, it's like, yeah, it is. It's definitely, I feel hunted, for sure. And I think that that's what keeps me motivated, right? Like, the fact that Hyde lives in town, or the fact that Curtis is so young, and I know that those guys are coming up, but there's other riders that are going to factor for sure. Summerhill will be great, coming up, and Krugoff will be great. Logan will be very strong. Like, these, you know, there's a lot of guys that I didn't mention that are going to be strong and going to be factors in the races. So I think winning Gloucester 10 times isn't something that you set out to do. It's just that happens. And what's motivating about that is different along the line every time. Like for me in 07, man, the way that I felt when I won that is a lot different than 2015 when you win it. It's just, they're two different worlds, and I was in two different places mentally and where I was at in my career. They're just, you know, one is like a career defining moment and the other is, this is part of my plan to succeed down the line. And, you know, when I'm there this time, I'm thinking a lot about like, wow, all my family came out and this is a, you know, incredible like tradition that we have. And this is a race that I really care about, but I also need these points. And this is part of my, you know, stepping across these lily pads to get across the lake, which is, you know, getting that international ranking and being able to start towards the front of these World Cups. And so, you know, part of it is racing. I'm doing racing because that's my job. And because these are great races, classic American races that I'm investing in as much as everyone else is. And also doing a good performance and just going out there and kind of using them to fulfill my goals. So I don't know, to end that question, like what motivates me? The motivation has definitely changed, but it really is all in a bigger, like global look, a big macro picture of how I'm succeeding in the World Cup versus like, did I win Gloucester for a 10th time? And so it's changed over the years, but I do think that it's very much the same in some ways, in a lot of ways, and different in a lot of ways.
So when you're talking about these lily ponds that you're walking over, and I like that. So when you approach these races, and it's not, you know, this isn't to have any less respect for your competitors, you're still going after them and racing against them, but are you looking at things that you can do during these races? Do you have certain strategical things that you're trying out or different technique things that you're trying out in a race circumstance that, you know, to help you out when you get over to Europe? Is any of that come into play, or is it just line up and we got to win this race?
I'd say last year there was a goal to win by a large margin. You know, I'm timing myself and using those races to time myself to do better laps, to push myself in different ways. And that is hard. I'm not even going to like try to beat around the bush on that. That's difficult. To be pushing yourself like that without anyone pushing you. This year, you know, Steven is for sure pushing me. But that's great. You know, I've changed as a rider. I've done a lot of core. I've done a lot of different things. And so there's areas where I'm looking at the course and thinking, this is really good for me. And I'm going to try to capitalize on this and use those skills that I've, you know, really put into motion, for training this year and try to make an extended gap and been able to do that and execute that. And so every race is in a World Cup, and it shouldn't be, because those are the races that you put up on a pedestal. And so I'm, you know, there has to be warm up races. There has to be practice races. We're dialing in equipment. We're playing with different things. We're like, you know, we're executing the art. Like this is as much as entertainment and art as it is sport. It's all of those things. It's about perfecting it and making it happen each weekend in different conditions. So I don't know. I don't really, you know, I hope that my level, I would say this, I hope that my level is pushing them to step up and be the best they can be, which in turn is really helping American cyclocross become something that's international, that's something that people aspire to get to and really love to be a part of and can make a living from it. And that's I think something that we do with the Jam Fund really well, is like having me be in town, having Steven be in town, having Ellen, Durin, Anthony, all of these different riders that live here, really shows that you can make a living from this sport and take it very seriously and achieve a lot and be a, you know, and be a professional cyclist with this, racing here and doing some international travel. So I guess those are all motivators in that long answer.
So speaking of American cyclocross, we in the U.S. have these riders like yourself, like Ryan, like Tim, like just going all the way down the line that people know, even Steven Hyde, somebody I was talking, I think on Twitter with somebody from, UK, that Hyde is like one of his favorite racers now, you know, so there people around the world are looking at U.S. cyclocross. It's a little mind blowing. So the frustration then is, we have this Pro CX, which is how many races? I can't even count how many races, 40, 50 races, you know, over the whole season. How do we get back to a series? How do we get back to a USGP? You know, you have Switzerland now who has the EKZ series. That is huge. That's an 8-race series. You know, all these other, you know, of course, the Belgian series. How does the U.S. get back to that? So we have a definable series where the best of the best can show up and we can start bringing in, you know, riders from other places who want to come over and race those races.
Oh, man, it's for sure a big question, and I think one that a lot of people look at. You know, it will take it just takes significant resource and someone that has the right, like, business attitude and also understanding of the sport to be able to execute something like that. And so it's not just, hey, Tim Johnson, go out and start the next U.S. Grand Prix of cyclocross, or, you know, let's get the band back together. It takes a large, you know, corporate sponsor or a large, you know, influx of money to make something like that come to life. And so that's, I think one of the real big things with, you know, what we were doing with Behind the Barriers TV was really trying to strive to showcase cyclocross, every asset of it, in from like real racing life to personal life, to, you know, funny to serious, and really showcase like the entire sport and encompass every aspect of it, best we could. And that was to hopefully lure in a larger non-endemic partner to create something special, not just for me to capitalize from, but for the entire sport and community to capitalize from. And so what does it take to get back there? It's going to take a lot. I think that there is like a really big disconnect between I can do this better than you, and I'll screw you over to make this happen for me mentality in some aspects of the sport. And that's something that I really believe we have to come together on. And I just think it's a growing pain. And I do think that there's, of course, ego in there as well, like with a lot of the promoters or organizers, that is always going to be there. But there has to be some amount of coming together to make a bigger thing. And you know, I always say that it's better to you know, walk, jog, run. And I think we were walking, and then we were running, and then now we're maybe back to like a light jog. But we really need to get into a stride with the way that the seasons brought from the beginning, like from where we're going, so that it's in a line, so that the trailers and trucks and teams are all going in the same direction at the same time, not, you know, from this side of the country to the other side, back to the other side. And I think we would really benefit. It would be incredible to have a national series again and just help the media and the different things that are out there understand and put these other races up on a pedestal. But yeah, that's negative, I would say. On the other side, I think there's some positive in there, is that when the USGP went away, it gave individual promoters a lot of ability to own their own event. And that has been really great, because when one event goes away, it doesn't mean the entire thing goes away. And I think that when you spread that out, it's a much healthier system. But I definitely think that system, if there's a overriding, like if all of those individual promoters still exist, but are able to exist in a series that has, you know, collective benefits to it with a bigger partner, that's, you know, I think a model that has worked in Europe and is, you know, pretty much across the board shown to be beneficial, because it helps the media and fans understand what races are put up on a pedestal and which ones aren't.
With those races, do you think we'll ever get to a point where they will be not only pro-only sections, but pro-only races? Or does that take, like, when you have to start charging admission for races and just the whole structure, that since cycling is not the number one sport in the U.S., that is just something we'll never see?
I mean, I think that people are looking for, again, cycling, you have to understand, cyclocross is a business, right? And so it's, people are looking for, it's a sport, but it's also a business. And people, sponsors and advertisers are looking for eyeballs. And they're looking for a way to connect with their fans and show value for their brands. And so, you know, when you start to talk about like creating, I guess, a value enough that people are willing to pay for it, you have to look at the group as a whole. And that doesn't just encompass the American riders, male and female. It encompasses the world riders. And so I think if American Cyclocross is able to jog and to create a series that's as beneficial or as impactful as the Super Prestige or the B Post or the World Cup, then we would definitely be able to lure over some European riders. And then at that point, I think the pro race would be the highlight. I definitely think that we are fairly far out on pro-only events. I just don't think that's the model that's been accepted here. And I do think that there is something that is really important about the way the courses are being set up and the way that they're being laid out and the challenges that are presented for the pros that needs to be addressed. I think that across the board, everyone sees that. There is, like, to get a little bit off subject, there is a happy medium there that's being executed now that I think everyone's being challenged, and then the amateurs are just doing it slower. But I did recently an article with someone from the Boston Globe, and when he came to interview me after Gloucester, he said, "Yeah, tell me why this is cool." And I thought, yeah, if you haven't seen it, if you didn't appreciate it for what it was when we were there, then you didn't love it, right? You weren't so impressed by the technique and the power, and you didn't admire it. And I think that type of admiration comes from things that people can't do themselves. And maybe this gentleman could race that course or could walk it or could ride it on his bike if he wanted to. But there are things that happen in, you know, European cyclocross, or when you do a beach sand, you know, a sand cross or something like that, that really make people drop their jaws. And that's the kind of, you know, things that I think about when I think about a world-class and non-endemic media and sponsorship world. It has things that regular people drop their jaw when they see. And I go to like the Tough Mudder type thing where you're just like, that looks impossible to do. And I'm challenged by that. And I want to do that. And so, that's, you know, if I can give one piece of advice collective to all the promoters, is that, you know, these oh shit moments, these things that really do catch people's attention and make people say, wow, I can't believe they did that. Those are the types of things that are going to take cyclocross from where it is now, participatory and professional, to a lot of sponsors and an event and like this amazing opportunity to just come out and to be a spectator. So,
right,
that's my sense.
Yeah, it's the you know, how many times have people just passed around clips of guys bombing down the sand in Zonhoven. You know, it's that type of thing that we don't have.
Yeah. But I do think that the understanding is there, and the courses are definitely getting more and more difficult. And I think that there's just so many things that have gone into it. And I do think in this aspect, we have certainly walked, jog, and now we might run with that. And so, you know, this is all going to happen. We're in a big, big picture. We're doing great. Like, the sport is growing. People are coming out and enjoying it. And there's more and more media about the sport. Like, we're doing a great job with what we're doing. I think this is very much, you know, my impression of it and me being a little bit hard on it, but also understanding that we are doing really great things with the sport right now.
You put a lot of time in the past into Behind the Barriers TV and did an amazing job, and it, you know, is, I'm going to call it a hiatus for right now. It's on hiatus for this year. Training wise and everything else, and stress wise, that's got to come into play as well. I mean, just from a selfish point of view, is this year different now that you're not worrying about that business side of it as well?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I wrote a pretty lengthy blog about the experience that, you know, I went through with Behind the Barriers and then later Behind the Barriers TV. And, you know, when I say that I didn't sleep at night and I woke up and, you know, I had everything. I mean, I had all those things that you have when you have a lot of stress in your life, tension, headaches, days that were canned by training. That's like very real things that happened for me and is unhealthy. And it's not for a professional athlete to be doing, and to still be doing, you know, well in races was, I don't know, sometimes I didn't believe it myself, like how I could win after being under such mental, you know, stress from, and really a lot of that came from just the monetary loss of of working so hard for something. And I think that people that know cycling know that you don't, I'm not making $1 million doing this. And so when you start to get into, the behind the barriers thing, that's a different business. And it was something that I was running, you know, really two businesses. My things changed for me because I was, Rafa Focus was very much a factory racing team that I was a racer for. And then at that same time, when we started Behind the Barriers, I started my own team because Rafa and Focus decided to disband that program as it was once known as a factory team, but continue to sponsor me. But that put a lot more on me. We had to get a manager and you know, all the logistics and everything that goes into it fell on me. And so you add that to the Behind the Barriers project, and that's a lot. not more than I treaded water for a long time with that, but it really did take its toll on me. And I think that it gave me, I would say, you know, a lot, the old Jeremy Powers that I knew in 2012 before I started the Behind the Barriers TV project, with regards to how I act and interact with my friends and family and the people that I come into contact with is definitely back, and I feel much more at peace. And I don't want to be that person that's like just dying to make the sport better. Like I just want to be me and do what I can. And so I felt like for a long time that I was the only one that could help and do something, or, you know, be in this position to make a big difference, a big change, because, you know, I'm one of the top riders here. And I don't think that that's true necessarily for myself. I think I took that a little too far, and I learned a lot of lessons from that. And so it's a, it was a really wild experience. I definitely have less stress in my life, and that's been, you know, I'd say probably the best thing that I could have ever done for myself. Cause if I had kept going at the rate that I was going, I would have just probably stepped away from it altogether. Like that one day you would have just been like, man, Powers retired. Okay. he's gone.
Well, hopefully we have a couple more years, you know, several until that happens. So let's talk about Europe a little bit. When we chatted after the race at Cross Vegas, you got your sixth place. You put on a good face about it, but you were visibly disappointed. That wasn't the result you were looking for. Stepping back from it, you know, a couple weeks, has your view of it changed at all? Have you put it into any different perspective, and has that helped you moving forward into Europe? Because one thing that I will say, and this is a very long question, but is that when I was watching your interaction, you're on that front row, which we've already, you know, heard from you and agree with, that's done with, that's, you know, no longer a goal, but that you're chatting with everybody there, it seems like you have that respect now that you are in that group. So have you accepted that? Has that changed your mindset? Has that changed your motivation when you're going in there? And are you going to treat these World Cup races any different because you're part of that fraternity now? Does that matter at all?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's a big mental change when you do get accepted by your peers as someone that's in it. And I think that, you're part of that ongoing show, and that the internationalization of the sport is not something to take lightly. You have to remember that all the Europeans coming over here it's a big deal for them to travel like that. They're very grounded in their you know, country and in their communities, and to leave home for this long it's not pro tour road racing. It's just, it's a different thing, cyclocross, and it's very grounded in Belgium and the Netherlands and in the country, you know, the countries that these guys live in. They're doing a lot of racing there. Even the Swiss riders, they're staying pretty home. And so I think that the World Cup, because it has so many points and things like that, is really pushing riders to have to leave. And so to say, like, you know, Klaus Van Torenhout said to me on the start line, and he's not a rider that I have a ton of interaction with, but, you know, like, we don't talk at every race. Whereas, like, when I see Sven Nys at every race, we say hello and we have a small chat. But, like Klaus said to me, hey man, I have a lot of respect for you. I've been up every day, you know, at 3 a.m, and it's been really hard to be here. And I was like, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. And, I think that there is a certain understanding that, you know, that there is a lot that goes into me going over and racing, and that they respect that. And so does that change, you know, when we're sprinting for fifth, if I get put in the barricades or not? Probably not, but it does for sure change if there's a moment in the race when they could put me into the tape, or or something that I think is there is a certain level of respect that has definitely come. And I think that they do, after having either been beaten, bested by me, how's that? It sounds nicer. Or been in a group with me or seen me race, that they understand that I put a lot into this and that this is a big sacrifice and a big deal for me to be over there. And yes, I do feel more accepted by the group. That for sure is there. And you asked another question about, you know, when I reflect on that race, and I don't believe after I watched it that I could have won the race, you know, period. I don't think, and I know that's probably weird to hear, but after seeing how Van Aert rode, I don't believe that I could have won the race. So maybe in a perfect world, I could have gotten second or third. If I had played my cards differently, I really believe that third was there. I think that if I had just had a little bit more power, I could have gotten across to that. At one point it was like a 15-second gap. And, you know, that's 7 seconds the lap, which I think is certainly doable. If I had just had a little bit more, you know, a little bit bigger motor, I could have done it. And that's certainly possible. But to say that I didn't prepare really well for the event and, like, train my butt off and go to altitude and all these things, it's like, at some point you just have to say, like, I honestly did control as many variables as I could. And I had a great lead up to it. And I, for the first time in my career, was in that position. And a lot of riders might not ever be in that position to even be looking at potentially getting on the podium of a World Cup. And so that's when I leave there and I look at the perspective part of it. That's something that is, you know, I always believe, even with like a national title or a big race, that you have to be in that position before you can actually be that position. And that's been true for me for a really long time. You know, for all the races that I've tried to do well in and then not been able to execute and then later been able to do with nationals or, you know, road races or big criteriums or things like that. I've never just done it. I've always had to be in that position, learn that stress or learn that race or learn the way that was going to feel and then been able to go and do it. It's kind of like slow learning, I suppose. But
last year, I think there was a story about training wise how one of the things that you were going to change was slowing down your cadence, so more power, lower cadence. Mm-hmm. Especially for these European races where there's a lot of sand, a lot of mud, where that seems to be the successful equation for these guys to get through that. Is that still your mindset, something that you're working on, and is there anything else that you've added to that to adapt to the European style of racing? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, absolutely. The European races just have more strength involved, which is why I've gone in such a different direction with my training. And it has a lot more strength and, you know, strength and cadence work in it and so on. I mean, when I was younger, like, we used to watch Cadel Evans and we used to talk about high cadence. And so all of my coaches always taught me, hey, Jeremy, you know, over 100, 90 to 110. Like, that's the zone you need to train in. And so, yeah, that's like what I was brought up in. And then now we get into these races in cyclocross and we're starting to do, you know, 400 watts at 50 RPMs. And it's like for an hour and it's hard. And it's hard to produce that low, you know, RPM to produce that amount of torque and to kind of get through. And then not only to be in that thing, but then to get off and either run or go up this really steep embankment and then go from, you know, 60 to 40 for 10 or 15 seconds, putting out 800 watts. It's like, they're very different efforts than riding along at 100 RPM. And so I've had to significantly change that, but I've had to do it over time because as anyone that trains seriously knows, you know, you can't just go out and do anything without a foundation. And that foundation doesn't just take a month or 2 months or 3 months. It takes a year. It takes 2 years to get to the point where I can go out and do 30 minutes of intervals at 50 cadence, you know, and some things have suffered from that. If you look at the way I used to race from now, at a race like Gloucester, it was harder for me because it's not as though I've changed as a person or I've gotten older or whatever. It's just so snappy and so sharp. And that's where I used to be incredible. And I used to just have incredible snap. But as I've gotten into these longer, lower cadence efforts, it's taken some of that snap away and changed some of that muscle fiber and the way that I'm recruiting energy and things like that. So I suffer in different areas now, but I'm stronger in other areas. And it's not surprising to see a rider that does well in Europe come here and on really these really fast, punchy courses that we have in the States not do as well because they're really a different style of racing altogether. And I remember, like, back in the day, and when we used to do this race that we're actually doing in Madison, it was in a different place, but Bart Wellens, Verbeken, Hoyla, all these great European riders came over, and like Ryan and I were able to win, I think, both dates. Actually, maybe Tim and I don't remember it all, but I won one day. I know that much. And so I just remember being like, man, this is wild, because these guys, you know, this is such a different thing for them. This is not the type of racing that they're used to. The ratios of power to turn are totally different in U.S. and European cross. So I've had to change my riding style quite a bit and match theirs, because that's the type of racing that I'm chasing now. And it just takes a little, I think it's more cardio and less snap in Europe. And I think here it's more snap and less cardio.
How about with weight training? It seems like you're doing more, especially upper body work. What's been your evolution in that? Because I'm assuming early on it was nothing, and now it seems like you've added a lot into that training.
There is, for sure. I think the biggest thing that I'm looking for is to not put on too much muscle mass, because as we all know, it doesn't help you go uphill quickly. And, you know, you've got to have a right balance. But I also want to leave races like this weekend and not feel fatigued on Sunday. And I think that achieving that right balance of having enough muscle mass and using it to be able to go out and do a good training session, a hard training session with, like, you know, a lot of needing to use a lot of upper body and being strong enough there, combined with, I guess just looking for that right amount is what I'm trying to say. It's like, you know, you don't want to be huge, because that's going to kill you. But if you do have, and it uses energy, truthfully, but you want to have that right balance. And so I think for my upper body stuff, the goal is to be at a place where I've increased some muscle mass so that I'm not as fatigued post race. But that I've not put on so much that I'm actually, you know, detrimental to how fast I go on the bike up a hill or otherwise.
So a lot of people now have listened 30 plus minutes. The only thing they really want me to ask you,
yes,
why are you still riding a bike with Canty brakes?
Ah, that's a great question. And one that deserves a proper and long answer. And I will tell you, at this very moment, it's because I have the equipment and I can. That's the simplest version of that answer. We have tons of equipment. We have, to give a sense, we have like more than 12 bikes kicking around. We have 6 Canty bikes, some of which live in Europe, some of which live here in our service course. We have tons of wheels glued. We have tons of disc wheels glued. We have tons of disc bikes. We have, I think, 8 disc bikes currently. I have one that lives in Colorado. I have one that lives here at my home. I've got 2 that are in Europe right now. I've got 4 that are on our truck. And so for Vegas, I felt like there was a very good chance that I wouldn't need the braking power that disc brakes provide. And so I wanted to go with the absolute leanest, lightest setup. And so I started my, because as I said, I pulled out all the stops for Vegas. I elected to start my season on Canties. And while I was doing that, the bikes were being prepped for a disc bike that I'm going to be riding that's a little bit different than the one that's coming out. And so, I'm going to be riding a different version of my same frame that's coming out. And I'm probably not supposed to talk too much about that, so I won't. But there's a couple of things that we've changed on that bike, not necessarily in the geometry or anything, but in the look. Let's just say that. And so in that, I've been training on both bikes. I've been training on my disc bike at home, and I've been training on my Canty bike. And I do prefer my disc bike, especially to train on and to have that extra braking power for that experience. As the conditions get gnarlier now and we get more precipitation, things like that, you're going to see me switch back over to my disc bike fully, because I think it's a much better system. I think it's definitely 2015 cyclocross. I know a lot of people really love the Canty brake. It was very much for me a Vegas thing. And in Europe last year, the reason that I was running Canty bikes was because there was the recall on the disc brakes. And because at the time that I made the decision to use disc or Canty, we didn't know if the disc brakes were going to be available to us. And so we had ordered a lot of equipment with Canty in mind because we thought we might need to run that last year. And ended up being able to use disc brakes. So we just decided to split the equipment. And in Europe, I would run Canty full time, and in the States, I would run disc. And so it was really at that time, it was just about having to make a decision in March of 2014 when I made the decision to have the Canty bike. And now that we have so much equipment, it's just that I can choose. And so for Vegas, I elected to run Canties because there's not a ton of stuff that you need disc brakes for. But definitely as we get into November and December, and as I get over to Valkenburg, you only have to watch that race once to know that Canties are great, but they're certainly not, they would not be the choice that I would have for a race like Valkenburg, because it has three really steep descents that definitely having that added brake power is going to be just easier on my body overall. And it has, you know, it has the type of performance that I want to use. So not seen in corporate lingo. I think that they're both good systems. They both certainly work, but I definitely value what disc brakes have done and the way that I can use the bike to corner and handle and stop faster and all that stuff. All those things are real, and it's amazing technology that I'm psyched to have. But yeah, I was just using Canty for a small amount of time here while we were kind of fully transitioning back over to disc from Vegas.
So next world.
Did that make any sense?
Yes. That was perfect. Okay. That was perfect. Okay. So traveling to your next World Cup race, what does that week look like? When do you get into town? How much training do you do in Europe beforehand? And then, you know, when do you leave again? What's the formula you've come up with to make that work?
You know, being on the East Coast has been is really good for a cyclocross rider that's traveling a lot to Europe because the time zones are shorter. And so I always now fly in the morning to London. I spend the night in London. I get in there in the evening around 9 p.m. I spend the night there. Usually the flying takes enough out of me that I'm pretty tired when I get there. So you know, I go to bed, let's even say it, at midnight in London. And then I wake up 8 a.m. the next day. And it prevents me a missed night of sleep. Whereas when you take a red eye, you almost always miss a night of sleep. You miss, you know, let's just even say you fly back and forth and you miss 12 nights of sleep. That's 12, you know, nights of sleep that are, you're not getting, you know, rejuvenated and back to normal. So that's just, you know, nixing that by flying during the day on both sides when you're, you know, leaving from here, going to there, by going to London, because that's the only way you can do it. And then also going back, leaving in the, you know, in the morning and getting here in the evening, it really sets your circadian rhythm up correctly. So that's part of the formula that's really valuable. And then when I get there on Wednesday. I fly on Wednesday to London. I get there on Thursday morning. I take the train over to Brussels, where my team, Molly, Brandon, and Tom, grab me at the train station. And then we drive up to the Netherlands, where I will work with USA Cycling to get ready for Valkenburg, which is on Sunday. So I'll do a spin on Thursday. It will be slow and I'll be tired. Friday, I will do still a little bit more just hanging out. And then Saturday, I'll do some opening up. And then Sunday, I will race. And then this year, I've actually added a race, which is an evening race, the Nacht van Woerden. It's a race that I did in 2005. And it's on Tuesday. And so I was kind of excited because I wanted to add, I'd like to add some European races. I was able to get a contract for the race. And so I'm going to hang out there until Tuesday with the team, and we're going to rip up a race in the Netherlands, that race. That's a C2, and see what we can do.
Nice.
And then I'll fly home on Wednesday afternoon.
Last question for you, and it's about your team, Aspire Racing. This right now is a team that supports one rider, Jeremy Powers. Mm-hmm. What is the future of that program?
Yeah, absolutely. We want to grow. I wanted to grow last year, but like all things, you know, I just really have learned that lesson the hardest way about trying to do something that doesn't necessarily make sense. And with, you know, I really go back to like that experience with Behind the Barriers TV, where I really forced the way that I thought that I could make this huge production happen, and regardless of money, I wasn't going to let that get in my way. I was just going to chase my dream and my passion. And my dream and my passion is to have a really, you know, great racing program that can benefit a lot of riders and help a lot of people, you know, get their goals. And right now we have, like I said, I just mentioned them all, actually, Molly, Brandon, Tom, you know, my wife helps a little bit with the program still, but myself, we have a great system, and we have a great, you know, we have a great program. And so we would like to grow. I need the additional sponsorship and partners to be able to kind of take the team from where it's at with one rider to two riders. I have, you know, the intel. I understand what it's going to take monetarily and staff-wise. But I'm definitely moving towards signing a second rider. It could be a male or a female. We're not really sure yet, but the goal is very much to take riders that have come from the Jam Fund, and bring them up through my racing team. You know, I'm not looking to sign a Belgian rider to my program, because it just doesn't fit with what the goal is. The reason that it's called Aspire Racing is so that the riders that are coming up through our nonprofit, through the Jam Fund, through what Al and Lucinda and I have created, is to be able to have them aspire to get to a pro team and to have a full ride that, you know, is a salaried racing spot and has every perk that they can imagine, and all they have to focus on is racing. So it is very much a part of the program to grow it, but I had to really temper that with, does this meet, you know, while I may want that, does that actually make any sense financially? And this year I wasn't able to do it, but we're definitely having conversations and looking for additional sponsorship to be able to grow the program and to make it bigger, and race in Europe and do all the things that we really are hoping for in the long term with Aspire.
Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today on Crosshairs Radio, and good luck out there in the coming weeks.
Thanks everybody for listening, and have fun, be safe. And Bill, thank you so much for all you're doing and for your time as well.
All right, and there you have it. That was Jeremy Powers. I want to thank Jeremy for taking the time to speak with us here on Crosshairs Radio. Also want to thank you all for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, please go to cyclocrossbook.com. Check out our Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches book that actually we did with Jeremy. So a lot of J-POW tips in there, and he is the model for all of the techniques that are discussed in the book. Also, crosshairscycling.com/shop, or you can go to svennis.com. Check out all the goods, all the shirts, socks, toe spikes we have available. You support that, and then we can pay to do more of these. If you need to get in contact, send us an email at feedback@cxhairs.com. Also, give a follow on Twitter at cxhairs, C-X-H-A-I-R-S. And on Instagram, also at CX Hairs, and on Facebook in the Crosshairs, CXHairs.com. Thanks so much, and we will see you next week.